We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, a wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you. Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 33 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling The Skin of the Earth, about two presentations I heard during the Wilkie Farm Field Day held June 28th. The Wilkie Research and Extension Farm is one of Washington State University's collection of research farms around eastern Washington. It is dedicated to large-scale and long-term research projects. This year's field day was titled simply, Everything Soil. For the record, soil is the skin of the earth because it is the outermost layer of the earth's crust. Dana Herron, a board member of the Washington Grain Commission, likes to remind everyone of the importance of soil by appending an anonymous quotation to the emails that he sends out. It reads, "Man, despite his artistic pretensions, his sophistication, and his many accomplishments, owes his existence to a 6-inch layer of topsoil and the fact that it rains." A brief aside here. This is the third time since I started these weekly podcasts last January that I have listened to experts talk about the growing impact of a declining soil pH on wheat production in eastern Washington. I don't think Dave Huggins, soil scientist at the Agricultural Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, intended for low soil pH to become the focus of his presentation. But when the topic is soil health, it's hard to avoid questions on the subject of pH, or what's called the master variable. Ordinarily, I like to follow a more linear path with people's presentations, you know, beginning, middle, end. But Huggins' observations about soil pH, which came near the conclusion of his presentation, are so important for farmers and landlords to hear about that I'm going to feature them up front. Extensive soil sampling at the Wilkie Farm has revealed soil pH in a range of 5.2 to 5.7. For the record, 7 is neutral. Low pH soils are high in aluminum, and those with expertise in the subject often talk about high aluminum or acid soils in the same breath as they say low soil pH. Aluminum is not a plant nutrient and isn't actively sought by the roots, but enters the plant through osmosis. It stunts roots and reduces the nutrient uptake. Declining soil pH is one of those double-edged swords because it is being caused by the application of nitrogen fertilizer, which enhances yield. Although all nitrogen forms have the potential to lower soil pH, some are worse than others, and anhydrous ammonia, which is the predominant source of nitrogen for eastern Washington wheat farmers, falls in that category. Huggins called the pH range at the Wilkie Farm, which is located outside of Davenport, Washington, not horribly bad as yet. But the lower pH goes, the more obvious the challenge becomes.
As you get below 5, that's when the aluminum in the soil solution starts to go up. It goes up exponentially. And also the base saturation tends to drop below 50%. And so the base saturation is how much of the cation exchange capacity, the charges that are on the surfaces of the organic matter and the clays, how much of that is occupied by bases, calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium. And so you want high base saturation to deliver those macronutrients and micronutrients to the plant itself. And as you drop below 50%, that means that much of that charged surface is being occupied by hydrogen and aluminum.
For those of you like me, for whom soil science was not one of the subjects taken in college, think of aluminum as an uninvited guest, which shoves the visitors you really want to see, macro and micronutrients, off to the side. The lower the pH, the more aggressive your uninvited guest behaves, or something like that. I'm not a scientist, and I don't play one on TV. Although low soil pH is a problem around the world, Eastern Washington, along with a few other places, does have a unique environment.
Acidification is prevalent around the world. And there's a lot of science behind, okay, what should we do? But what's different about our situation is that there's not very many places in the world, except here, Australia, where you really had a much drier climate and where there was quite a few bases to begin with. So if you look at many parts of Europe, it's much wetter, so much wetter climate. Same thing with the Midwest and back in the Northeast, much wetter climate. And that they started out with soils that were already fairly low in pH and were conducive to fairly rapid acidification because many of the bases had already left the soil because they leach with the water.
Huggins says there's a lot of science that tells us what needs to be done with regard to low soil pH, and it can be summed up in two words, calcium carbonate. One word, if you prefer the name of the raw material in which it is found, lime. Calcium carbonate reacts with acidity by forming carbon dioxide and water, reducing acidity and increasing pH in the soil. Although other parts of the world have been addressing the problem of acid soils for hundreds of years by shoveling on the lime, our region's relative dryness and the soil's remarkable condition to begin with has delayed the process. Now the time has come for us to start to apply lime too. The question is, how can farmers get it on their fields in a quantity and at a price that is economically sustainable over time? The Pacific Northwest is blessed with a lot of natural resources, but having a nearby lime source is not one of them. I've been told the cost of hauling in material is about the same as the material itself, and the amounts of lime that must be applied to move the soil pH number is enormous, as in tons per acre. Although a concentrated liquid product is available, it's not cheap.
So we know what the solution is. We're going to have to add calcium carbonate at some point in time. There's things that we can do that can slow the process down in terms of, you know, how efficiently we use nitrogen, what kinds of crops we grow, this type of thing. But we're acidifying. And at some point of time, we'll have to apply lime. If not now, it'll be into the future. Faced with that serious issue, it becomes really important to target, well, what pH you really don't want to get below.
Yeah.
And you also need to target, well, what pH do we want to get up to if we're applying lime? And so those two questions are, I think we've got the lower one answered, but in talking about, well, what should we target at trying to maintain to, because it impacts nutrient availability, disease, you know, all kinds of things. Rhizobial, you know, and nitrogen fixation from N2 fixation for legumes, et cetera. So different crops, again, different tolerances of where pH should be. And the legumes are impacted first. So, you know, from that standpoint, they would probably like it a little bit more basic than this is, even at 5.3. They like it more at 5.6, 5.7 or above type of thing. If you look at the textbooks, they like 6.5. I say, well, that's out to lunch from our perspective here economically. And, you know, I would like to see, particularly in the more cereal-dominated areas, that we try to target around 5.5 or so. Our pH now is being buffered by the organic matter itself. So it'll keep buffering right around 5.2 or so and not move below that until all the buffering of the organic matter is consumed. That's why a lot of these pH measurements that you see now all are around 5.2, 5.3. They're buffered around the organic matter. They'll keep that way. But once it starts to consume that buffer and go through it, then it'll drop again rapidly below 5. And that will happen quickly. And so you need to be aware of that situation, and that's when the horse is out of the barn.
Now, I'm pretty sure what Huggins meant when he said, when the horse is out of the barn, but just to be sure, I looked it up. There were a couple of descriptions. Either it's a solution that comes too late to be of any use, or it's too late now to do anything about the problem. I prefer the latter because we know what the solution is, don't we? We're just running the risk of taking too long to do anything. And Huggins said even starting the process tomorrow will not result in instant results. but doing nothing is not feasible in the long run.
It takes about, 10 years almost for it to get down into the top 6 inches. You know, so it's a very slow process from the standpoint of movement of calcium carbonate down. So I wouldn't be too worried about that in the short term anyway. In the longer term, interestingly enough, we did calculate, okay, after how many years at the rate bases are leaving, the surface would be depleted of bases. And we came up with the back of the envelope 170 years from now with the process. At the rates that are going down in terms of acidification, we will have no bases in the upper soil. We'll have to do something eventually to replace bases.
As I said up front, Huggins backed into the pH portion of his presentation, and he had other interesting things to say about soil health in light of the Wilkie Farm soil test results. For instance, he found that boron and zinc were deficient, the zinc declining along with the pH.
Soil tests, again, for the top 6 inches showed that there was, in quite a few of the samples that we took, there were both deficiencies in boron and zinc. And, you know, boron as it gets below about a half a part per million, and zinc as it gets below about 1 part per million, again, really small amounts, but crucial and essential micronutrients. So from that standpoint, both boron and zinc appear to be deficient in the farm here. And I know boron doesn't need to be applied in very high rates. It's a micronutrient, and the danger there a little bit is that boron is also toxic as it gets into higher concentrations. And actually, you know, from a university perspective, we like to see it broadcast rather than band it, because the band actually concentrates the boron, and basically creates potentially a toxic zone of high boron concentration right in the band itself. And so you like to see more of a broadcast in liquids, even better. You don't want to, and the zinc, what's kind of interesting as well, you can see there's a general trend of the zinc declining with soil pH, and that's what we would expect to see.
To close out Huggins' segment of the podcast, I'm going to take you back to the beginning, when the soil scientist was in a 7-foot-deep trench using a long, sharp knife to trace the root of roots through the soil. Not unlike many of us, they also seek the easier path.
Roots like to follow the path of least resistance, so structure actually plays a huge role in soil in providing pathways for roots to travel. One thing I look for after soil depth is, are there restrictive layers? And these types of soils, we can have restrictions from two different kinds of situations. One are what we call argillic horizons. Those are clay layers that are in the subsoil. Those clay layers can be hard enough that the roots actually can't penetrate them very well. And so they're restrictive, not just to roots, but sometimes to water as well.
Huggins also spent a lot of time referring to two soil tests I wasn't familiar with. One was the Solvita test. That's Solvita. It measures the soil's CO2 respiration, which gives a general indication of soil health. Another test is called the Haney soil test, named after Rick Haney, a soil scientist with the USDA who invented it. It considers many of the same soil nutrients as standard tests, but incorporates a measure of the microbial activity of the soil. If you haven't considered it already, you should check out just how healthy or unhealthy your soil is using one of these tests. Now, I'm not the brightest bulb in the box, but one of the things I am better at than most is connecting the dots. And when it comes to challenges facing the next generation of Eastern Washington wheat farmers, I believe dealing with low soil pH is going to be near the very top of the list. I hope there's people at WSU, the ARS, and private industry who aren't just quantifying the problem, but are actually looking for economical solutions. Stuart Wiest, who serves as a soil scientist at the ARS station outside Pendleton, gave a fascinating presentation on his research looking at direct seeding in very dry areas. You'd be hearing from a portion of that presentation now if I'd actually pressed the record button. Since I didn't, I talked to Weiss afterwards. Direct seeding, which is also called no-till, started in the higher precipitation areas of eastern Washington, but the drier areas also got into the act for a while, until a few moisture deficit years caused most farmers to pull back from the practice. But a few courageous individuals continue to experiment, for good reason, Weiss said.
Well, what's interesting is that Direct seeding seems to be become economic in the very dry areas where we really haven't been that successful, as successful as we'd like to think, with deep furrow seedings. And so they're finding that in areas where the winter is mild enough for a later seeding to catch up, they're actually penciling out with the reduced labor costs, reduced tillage, even with the more expensive equipment, they're penciling out better returns with maybe some slight reductions in yield some year with no-till, that rather than trying to get that seeds on moisture and use a deep furrow drill and hope that it doesn't crust over.
Now, most farmers measure themselves by the amount of bushels they put in the bin, but you're telling me that that is not the accurate measurement.
Well, the farmers I'm talking to say they realize they might be getting lower yields in some of the best years, but they think they're getting better yields in the poor years. And with the reduced labor costs and the way they're operating their farm and the slim margins that they already had, they're pretty happy right now with the way things are going in no-till.
And now you were talking about the difference between conventional tillage and minimum tillage and direct seeding. Tell me about the different components in the soil in each of those and why it's important to know.
Well, I study water infiltration and I study evaporation. And in terms of water infiltration, it was really clear in my research, in researching various methods and ways and in all sorts of different soil types, the important thing is that we have that we protect the soil surface. What happens is that individual soil particles will separate, float around, and seal the soil surface, and that's why we get a crust. And that sealed soil surface after a rainfall keeps water from penetrating. And it doesn't really matter about root holes and cracks and wormholes and stuff under the surface. If the surface seals, then water simply won't go in the soil. It'll tend to run off.
And you compared that to having hair in the drain of your shower. Explain that.
Well, everybody has noticed that it doesn't take a whole lot of hair in your bathtub drain to plug it completely. And it really doesn't matter how big the pipes are under your house. That tiny little layer of scum and hair will just stop water flow. And it's the same with the soil. It's really the top inch. If you can get water past the top inch, you can get tremendous water flow, even in a no-till soil that seems a little bit denser. But that's really key. So you either need lots of residue on the surface to protect the surface from raindrop impact, or you need high organic matter, and you want that right on the surface. So that's where tillage comes in. If you don't invert the soil, you don't dilute that high organic matter right at the surface, and then the soil particles don't fall apart and slake and go and plug and make a sealed surface.
As I listen to Wiest now, I understand his explanations better. But at the time, I was a little lost how small particles became a big plug. I recognize now that I ask him the same question several different ways. Here, Wiest uses another approach to get his point across.
What matters is that we have fewer small aggregates, really tiny aggregates, fewer individual silt grains and clay floating around. We don't want stuff floating around in the water as it tries to soak into the soil. So what we want...
And why is that?
Because when the soil particles are loose, the tiny soil particles are loose, they will move until they get trapped. And once they get trapped, just like the hair moves down to the drain, once it gets down to the drain, it stops. And then more will come on top of it and stop. And pretty soon you're plugged. And that's what happens to our soil surface. If we have very few fine, independent sand grains, silt grains, then there's not as much to float around and plug the surface and create a crust. Some people have worried about, especially in low rainfall areas, if they have too much residue on the surface, does that intercept the rain and then have it evaporate right off the residue? And in my experience, and Bill Schillinger had a great study where he put on tons of extra residue on the surface, I've never seen there be too much residue. More residue always helps. And my maximum residue levels on my experiments is where I get the best rainfall penetration and the least evaporation after that rainfall event. So it's a very short time period, but that's what helps us store more water.
But oftentimes farmers are burning their residue because they can't get through it to seed. Are you finding that that is perhaps something that should be abandoned because the new seeders can seed through this really intense residue?
Well, yeah, burning residue, then you basically lose any benefit you have in terms of storing water. In fact, you leave a surface that tends to dry pretty severely. So a lot of growers who have a lot of residue are trying to figure out ways of getting through the residue. I think that's going to profit them. They're pretty excited about getting better stands in a dry fall with thicker residue. But yes, it is a struggle to get your drills to work in that situation. But they're dedicated to doing that because they've seen such good stands with more residue.
That reminds me of a joke about the three most important things about real estate. Location, location, location. Sounds like for Wiest, the three most important things about direct seeding in a dry environment are residue, residue, residue. Wheat farming is changing fast, and those who expect to make a living from it better get on board the super information highway. There's a station right outside your door. It doesn't matter what aspect of wheat farming we're talking about. It's going to change. Make like a Boy Scout and be prepared. That's it for episode 33 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling the skin of the earth. Hope you enjoyed the show and will join me again next time for another episode of Wheat All About It.
Out in the country where a woman's called a gal, she's more than a lover, she's a farmer's best pal. We marry them for life, we marry with a vow, and even in the night we know how to plow. Our children have two parents, our children have a home, they don't grow up with no edible syndrome. We're the backbone of this country, the spirit of its soul. Best you ask for whom the bell tolls. We feed you, we feed you.